All right, so since you haven't heard anything I've said, welcome to the Shooting Bench. It's the 14th of July, and we're going to get Doc on here in just a couple of minutes. Sorry about the delay there. And we're going to spend the rest of the time talking about guns. A couple things I wanted to mention. I know you've all heard about the terror attack in France. Last I heard, 77 dead, over 100 injured. I think, folks, this is the tip of the iceberg. I think there is more to come. So the other thing we have here, and I want you folks in the Pacific Northwest to pay particular attention here. There's a restaurant up there by the name of, let me find it here. Here we go, Lucky Teriyaki. This particular one is in Skagit County. And I can't remember the name of the cotton picking name of the town. But anyway, sheriff's deputies went in there. And as they were leaving, they were told not to come back. Cedro Woolley, Washington is where it is. Cedro Woolley. 214 Ball Street. Cedro Woolley, Washington. 360. Copy this phone number down in case you decide to call and let them know what you think about this. 360-855-3340. Lucky Teriyaki Restaurant in Cedro Woolley, Washington. I think they're individually owned and operated, and that's good. If it's a chain, then get all of them. But they told these cops, these sheriff's deputies, never to come back. And they said, not only that, we want you to tell any other law enforcement you see them not to come back, not to come in here either. So I can't imagine that this is going to go well for this restaurant. I wish I lived there so I could not go there. But I'll just have to not go there from here, I guess. But I don't know what that's all about, but I know that they are catching ever-loving hell on their website. So we'll see how well this works. Another thing. Last thing before we get Doc in here. There was three women in their 20s. And my guess is, I mean, this is just a shot in the dark, so I don't know. But my guess is that all three of them are blonde. Probably golden, perfectly yellow blonde. This was in the Muskegon River. They wanted to go inner tube and had never been, this is in Michigan, I think, had never been inner tubing before, so they said, well, all right, let's just go buy inner tubes and let's do this thing. So they go down to the river there to get in, and they're wondering how they're going to get back. And the guy, friendly individual on the bank, said, it's easy. You just get in right here, and the river goes in a circle, and it comes back to this point. And they said, cool. And they jumped in and took off. Well, they traveled till almost dark. Didn't ever make it back to where they come from. Imagine my surprise when that didn't happen. And they pulled over to the shore and spent the night hugging a tree and screaming and hollering. And the next day a fisherman heard them and called 911, got them rescued. They didn't have their phones, had nothing with them, and so they were just helpless out there. So thanks to the friend, and I'm guessing that there's not a lot of rivers out there that actually run in a circle like that, like this kind gentleman explained to him. But anyway. Okay, well, let's. I've already taken up more time than what I told Doc I was going to take, but I didn't know I was going to screw up in the beginning here. So, if everything is sound is okay, I'm going to bring Doc in RAT right now, and we're going to talk about stuff. Doc is uniquely qualified to talk about stuff. He spent a little while the other day telling me about...
Good evening, Cope.
There he is. Doc, how are you this evening?
I'm good. And yourself?
Man, if I was any better, I'd have to be twins.
Well, I had a long day on the motorcycle, dodging rain for about 150 miles, but
wow.
I got everything done. You and I had discussed and
good.
Got home in one piece.
Glad to hear it. So everything went well, I guess, as well as it could under the circumstances.
And that's sort of perhaps a good... I think we have a little problem dropping out here. Do you have me 5x5?
Yes, sounds good here. Let me find out what the chat room thinking here. You guys got good sound there?
You had just dropped out on me momentarily.
Let's see what everybody else is doing. All right. Peanut Rider says we're good to go.
All right. Well, we'll keep on keeping on. I was going to say, as some of the people in chat understand, and I discussed this with you, today is my son's birthday, and he had died on December 27th of last year. So I just had a strong calling. You might say I was strongly moved to go down to the location of his death and pray and take communion. And that's in many religious denominations frowned upon. That is self-administration of communion. And so I had to call around and talk to a number of pastors who would bless the sacrament. And of course, you know, as I did this, I started to reflect on all the different Christian denominations and all of their peculiar or different or other ways of celebrating communion. And, you know, Cope, you and I discussed this briefly.
Right.
Some denominations will take wine. Some will take grape juice. I think you had said that the LDS takes water, if memory serves correctly.
Yep.
And others take, as far as the host goes, others will take tiny wafers or some form of unleavened bread or some form of regular bread. And I don't argue with anybody about it. You know, we're infinitesimally tiny, the equivalent of grains of sand in the universe compared to the majesty of God. So I don't pretend to have any of those answers. And I mention that because similarly, if you recall, we were going to do tonight's show on all my firearms pet peeves.
Yep.
And we did that last Thursday, and I think it was generally appreciated by the audience. And so we're going to do it again, have a more expansive version of it. But the point I want to make is that with most of these things, there are 100 different answers. Some of them are multiple valid answers. Some of them are bad answers, okay? I am not afraid to criticize the things I think are tactically unsound, and I will give my reasons for doing so. But a lot of the stuff here that falls into the umbrella of my pet peeves are not necessarily wrong. Okay, so I want the audience to understand this. I'm not condemning your particular choice or your particular weapon necessarily. I'm telling people what are my, emphasis on my, pet peeves regarding firearms and related issues. Fair enough?
Yep, sounds good. They're saying your audio is weak. I don't know. I've got everything turned up here. Can you turn your audio up a little bit?
I can try. How's that?
Well, let's see what everybody thinks here. Sounds a little louder over here, so we've got
if that's a little better.
All right. Sounds all right to me. Let's go ahead
okay.
on with it.
Well, I'm not in chat, so I'm not getting the... I mean, I can open the chat window, but I'm not getting feedback directly from the audience right now. But does my voice sound louder now? Am I modulating better?
It does.
Okay, good. All right, let's go. Well, let's just jump right into it. One thing that's affected me personally is eyesight, and I don't think I'm going to get much disagreement here. I had cataracts developing for a number of years, and they began to adversely affect my shooting as well as other things. So when I finally went to the doctor last year, late last year, He said my eyesight had degenerated to the point that I would no longer pass a standard driving test.
Hmm.
So I had to, you know, save my shekels to go and have the cataract surgery done on both eyes. I could only afford to have one done at a time. And it made a drastic difference. So, number one, if your eyes aren't right, you dropped out. I didn't hear you, Cope.
Well, I just said good. I'm glad to hear that.
So if your eyes aren't right, don't keep putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. Just go get your eyes fixed and be over and done with it. Let's see. My next pet peeve is people choose the wrong weapons for the wrong applications. And then worse, they become married to a specific weapon and don't want to learn anything else. So an example I'll use is front pocket carry. Now, that's not my favorite method of carrying, but especially here in the deep south where it might be 98 degrees and 98% humidity, your carry options are often pretty limited.
Yeah.
So I have a couple of carry pistols, and they're completely different that I use on a regular basis. One is the humble little Russian Makarov, which I have dehorned, so it's easily removed. And the other, I've got a 357 Smith & Wesson Bodyguard. That, for people who haven't seen it, is a double-action, single-action revolver, but it's got what some people call a camel hump shrouded hammer.
Uh-huh.
Very easy to remove from the front pocket. So don't stick with a weapon that doesn't suit your attire just because you like the weapon. Are you there still?
Yep. I'm afraid to talk because you keep thinking I'm cutting out, so I'm just listening here so I don't mess you up.
Okay, you may not be cutting out for the audience. What happens, what I'm hearing on my end, the first word or two you speak is choppy, and then your audio sounds normal.
Okay.
All right. So
it's probably good on the chat room.
If you're going to talk, speak in extended sentences.
All right.
So, in other words, you know, I like 1911s, as everyone knows. Cope and I go back and forth about this in a half-joking fashion. But in the summer, I'm not going to try and stuff a 1911 in my front jeans pocket. You know, so we got to be practical about these things. Don't get married to a weapon, and that includes Glocks or anything else, that doesn't fit the method of carry that you're going to have to employ. What would you add to that, Cope?
Nothing. I think that's, I always tell people to dress, figure out the gun that you want to carry and dress around it. If you refuse to change your clothes, then you may have to change your gun. You know, people say, well, I don't wear a belt, or I don't wear, untuck my shirt, or I don't do this or that and the other. Well, you know, you're going to have to decide. You're going to have to, if you want to carry a gun, you're going to have to make up your mind what, how you're going to carry it and dress around it and learn to like it. If that's what it takes. The pocket carry for me doesn't work at all with all the stuff that I've got in my pockets and everything. And I know that there was one guy in Flor Vista, New Mexico, and I've talked about him on the show before, carried a little .32 gun in his pocket for fun, and wound up shooting himself in the femoral artery on his presentation and died waiting for the ambulance.
Well, that's very, very possible. People don't appreciate the danger of femoral artery wounds. So with anything, with any method of carry, there is a possibility of a self-inflicted wound. So that's another thing you have to discuss. You may recall on a previous show, Cope, that you and I discussed shoulder holsters. And
right.
And you agreed with me. I explained that I'm not a big fan of shoulder holsters.
Nope, not at all.
Because for a number of reasons. For one thing, they are relatively slow to bring into action. And for another, in almost any conceivable scenario, you wind up sweeping your weak arm.
Yep.
And, you know, there are few things worse in a gunfight than shooting yourself and becoming your own victim.
How embarrassing would that be?
So, you know, I do have a couple of shoulder holsters. Mainly, I'll use them for the rare occasions when I'm going to take a handgun hunting. You know, like I've got a shoulder holster for my Super Blackhawk.
That's exactly what I use mine for.
And if I, you're out in a desert or semi-desert environment, I'm down here in the swamps and marshes, so a lot of things happen. I've been known to fall out of the boat. Sometimes I've got to ford small canals or bayous. Often the bottom of my canoe or boat will have water in it, and that just keeps the weapon high and dry. But in a hunting scenario, I don't have to practice any sort of a combat fast draw. And I can safely and smoothly remove that big old hog leg revolver from that shoulder holster. That's not quite the same scenario as suddenly you realize, you're in the middle of an armed robbery or somebody started shooting at you. Vastly different tactical scenarios.
Agreed.
I've got a whole list of things here, but I'm going to go to near the bottom of my list, because it's talking about holsters again. And I mentioned the other night that I like belt slide holsters, simple leather belt slide holsters, because mm-hmm. it's a minimalist KISS, the acronym, Keep It Simple, Stupid Approach.
Yeah.
I'm not telling anybody out there that you have to go and rely on a belt slide holster. You don't have to like a belt slide holster. There are other holsters that work. I just have specific reasons for liking those. I've been using them for going on, 35 years. They're simple. They work. They have no retention devices, and I'll get into that later. They work strictly by friction and gravity, and I've never lost a pistol from a belt slide holster. Carried them for many, many years. Full-size service pistols.
Mm-hmm.
Never had one tumble out of my belt. Never lost one. Never had one come out of a belt slide holster while sitting in a vehicle or riding a motorcycle or what have you. So, for me, anyway, that issue has been solved. I don't think there is a danger of losing your weapon because you've got them in a simple belt slide holster. But let's go back to different methods of carry and wardrobe considerations. This is a small beef. I'm not saying it's wrong, and I actually do own some inside waistband holsters that I use rarely, but I do use them. Here's the problem with inside waistband holsters, and it can even be a problem with outside waistband holsters, but it tends to be less so. And that's during the course of the day, and Cope, you know this as well as I do, after you carry a sidearm long enough, you almost forget it's there.
Right.
When someone first begins to carry a pistol for the first time, they're 100% conscious of it. And as the months and the years go by, they become less and less conscious about it. But, you rely on your muscle memory and such to instantly react to it if you need it. But here's what I find happens. It's happened to me before. I know it's had to have happened to you. Never happened in a gunfight, thank God. But during the course of the day, your shirts tend to ride up and bunch. The material tends to bunch.
Mm-hmm.
This is true with even tight or fairly tight t-shirts. And what I have found embarrassingly common is that, and it's a little more prone with an inside waistband holster than an outside waistband holster. Most people will carry their inside waistband holster slightly to the rear of the center axis of their hip,
right,
or even in the small of their back. Okay, so during the course of the day, your shirt's riding up and bunching, and what happened is you go to slap your butt and grab that pistol, and you wind up grabbing a handful of shirt as well as the weapon.
They need to work on their presentation if they do that.
Of course they do, but I'm saying it seems to be, it's a problem I've seen happen. And it just seems to be a little less likely with an outside-the-waistband holster, especially a high-riding type holster, than it does with the inside-waistband holsters. Again, I'm not saying don't use an inside-waistband holster. It's just something else to be aware of. I've seen guys, man, with the sheriff's department, you'd see guys who'd take their sport jacket off, and you'd see their shirts all bunched up around their weapon. I know you've had to mm-hmm. see that before, Cole.
Yep.
So it's one of those things, you go to grab the weapon, even when your muscle memory's, fully in gear, you grab that grip, and you've got maybe between the palm of your hand or the soft pad of your hand, you've got a piece of fabric stuck in there, and it can slow you down momentarily.
Right.
So it's the kind of a thing that wardrobe choice has to come into play. You have to be aware of these sort of things when you decide whatever kind of holster you're going to carry.
That is correct.
Let's see. Another thing. Now, see, so far, Cope and I haven't had any disagreements, which is disturbing and distressing for this show because we're supposed to be at each other's throats. But I'm sure we'll...
Well, you know, there's some things here that just... I don't know what to say. It's just too perfect. There's no way to argue with it.
Another thing I'm sure you're going to agree with here is I don't like purse carry for women.
Nope, I don't either.
Probably 90% of the women who've gotten CCW permits or in constitutional carry states where it's allowed, they carry their handgun in their purse. Multiple problems with that. In petty crime, the purse is always the first thing the criminal goes for, and typically in a purse-snatching scenario. So what you've done, you've put your weapon in a prime target for the thief to steal. So then most new concealed carry holders don't really have their situational awareness geared up 100%. And most purse snatchers do not come up to a woman from the front, approach her, and say, "Madam, I'm about to steal your purse."
That's right.
The most common way for a woman to have her purse snatched is the thief stealthily approaching her from the rear and sliding it off her shoulder. Okay, now you've got no purse, you've probably got no cell phone, and worst of all, you don't have your handgun. It's in the bad guy's hand.
Right.
So... again, wardrobe choices, a lot of decisions to be made here. Most women don't like to wear belts, but if the ladies can adjust their wardrobe, some sort of belt carry is going to be infinitely preferable to purse carry.
Yep.
The second problem with purse carry is most women have the tendency to insist on withdrawing the handgun from the purse before they use it. In close-up encounters, deadly force encounters, you don't have to do that, ladies. Just shoot through the purse.
Right.
Purses are a lot cheaper than funeral services, believe me. Okay, no arguments with me yet.
Not yet. We'll get there.
All right, okay. Here's another of my pet peeves. And that's people who automatically assume that all ammo will work in their pistol. And, you know, I've been doing this for decades. I love to go to the gun shows and trade and collect and spend time on the range. And you would not believe the number of times I've heard somebody complain about the unreliability of a given pistol, only to later discover that they were using poorly compatible ammunition or they were using a poorly compatible magazine.
Right.
Okay.
Can't argue with that any.
You know, I've had friends say, "Hey, Doc, can you take a look at this gun for me?" I mean, I'm going back for years and decades this has been happening. You know, "Can you take a look at this? Take a look at my gun for me, man. It's just not feeding right, or it's not ejecting right, or this, that, and the other." And I always ask them what kind of ammunition they're using. And a lot of times they don't remember. I shot it all at the range. I don't have any. When you're going to diagnose pistol problems, you almost always have to begin with the ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, haven't you seen that coat?
Yeah, we saw it a lot, especially in Farmington at the store where we had so many people coming in, and it was just, I bet it was at least once a week we'd have somebody come in and say, the gun was doing this, that, and the other thing, and it was just a matter of either, you know, dirty ammunition, old ammunition. I had a guy brought a 1911 in one time and had some ammunition from World War I. It was dated 1918. And
right.
some of them were squibs, and they just went in and said it wasn't the gun's fault. Had another guy brought in a 17 Mach 2. Are you familiar with that one?
I don't know. It's 17 Mach 2?
Yeah, it's a little smaller than the 17 HMR. It's basically a 22 long rifle neck down to 17 caliber. And this guy brought a gun in, and it wouldn't shoot, and what he had done, he shot not one, not two, but three 22 long rifles in this gun. It had a lead chamber cast in there. Luckily, it was low pressure enough it didn't blow the gun up. But when I pulled all the lead out in one piece, it looked like a 17 Mach 2 cartridge.
Right.
So, and we saw this stuff all the time. I've had people bring 270s in that they have fired 308s out of. Once here in Arizona and twice in Farmington.
Yeah, and I haven't had that personally happen to me, but I've experienced similar things, you know, secondhand or through people I know. You know, and this brings us back to a point. Here, Cope and I might have a little room to disagree, and the show might get a little more interesting. But, you know, a big pet peeve of mine is constantly hearing people harp about how unreliable 1911s are.
Oh, and boy, here we go.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Cope. What?
I said, oh, boy, here we go.
Okay, and I want to give my take on this. The patents on 1911s expired generations ago. So around the world, you have had scores of different manufacturers make these pistols. You have probably had hundreds of different manufacturers make magazines, both to government specs and their own designs. So what has happened, Peanut Rider, I think he's still in the room, the engineers use a term, something to the effect of tolerance stacking, or something equivalent. What happens is the different manufacturers, even if they start initially operating off the same blueprints, they make their variant a little different here or a little different there than the next guy does. And so you'll find that somebody's got some off-brand 1911 or some custom-assembled 1911 and a magazine from God knows where, and then they're trying to shoot some variant or another hollow-point ammunition through it, through a military-type pistol now, let me be clear on that.
Mm-hmm.
And they wonder why the weapon doesn't work. Okay? When the 1911 was originally tested and accepted for U.S. Army service, it went through 19,000. It's not 1,900, 19,000 cycling operations before the first weapon-related malfunction occurred. That was well over 100 years ago. And by anybody's standards in the current century, 19,000 operational cycles before a failure is not bad going.
No, I'd say that's admirable right there. And I've always, you know, I've always said that the military 1911s fed, you know, ball ammunition with decent magazines. You know, I never experienced a malfunction the whole time I was in the Army. But you get these people that have tried to modify them and make them better and make them tighter and make them more accurate and make them prettier and put more crap on them. And they put all this high-speed, high-tech, wide-mouth, hollow-point ammunition in them, and they don't work anymore. I've seen $3,000 guns that didn't work as well as a Jennings. I mean, it was embarrassing.
Right.
But the old $300 guns work great.
Last week, you and I talked about testing your personal weapon before you feel comfortable with it. And I said my rule of thumb is 500 rounds. You said 200 rounds, but I'm not going to quibble on that point. The gist of the advice is that you need to shoot your weapon extensively with the type of ammunition you're going to use until you have confidence in it. You know that weapon, which is a machine, it's only a machine, so that you know that it is going to work correctly.
And your ammunition is going to work correctly.
That's a component. Heinz Guderian, the famous Panzer general in World War II, said that the engine of a tank is just as much a weapon as its gun. And the point he was making is that all of these components come together. They're all critical to the functional use of the given weapon. So, you know, if you have a Panzer, if you have a tank and the engine's blown, well, what you've got effectively is a pillbox that's not very good.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer a tank. If you've got a pistol and the ammunition you're using won't work, you've got a club.
Yep, exactly.
So what I tell people to do, and what I do with a new pistol that I want to carry, and it hasn't gone through my rigorous 500-round test yet, especially on 1911s, but this is true of almost any semi-automatic pistol, I will carry a premium hollow point round in the chamber, and the rest of the magazine I load with military spec hardball. because then I can be 99.9% the thing is going to shoot when I need it.
Right. Right, and that's I'd never heard of anybody doing that before when you told me that the other day, and that's a pretty darn good idea, especially if you pick up an unfamiliar gun or something you don't know anything about it, and if you have the option, I think that's a great idea. Stick a hollow point in the tube. Obviously, at least that one's going to go off if the gun's functioning properly, and then you've got a lot better chance of the rest of them feeding, especially if you're unfamiliar with it, to put hardball ammunition in it. That's not a bad idea with the 40s either, since it's most of the full metal jacketed stuff is flat nose, so I still get a little bit of shock effect, if you will, better than the round nose. But I like that idea.
And this is more effective, obviously, with 45 ACP, purely because the bullet has more surface area and it's heavier than it is with a 9mm, but I don't assume 9mm are all going to work straight out of the box either.
Right.
So, you know, I got a box full of 9mm. I don't hate the cartridge, but I'll do the same thing. I'll put a premium hollow point factory load or one of my own reloads up the spout, and I put mil-spec hardball in the magazine until I've tested it and I know what it's going to work with and what it's not going to work with.
Yep. Can't argue with that, any. It's a good choice.
Okay. Do you have anything to add to that, or do you want me to go on to my next pet
peeve?
Nope.
I think you just move right on. I think that was we pretty well covered that. That's a good idea. I like that.
Okay. My next pet peeve is the modern hatred of grip safeties. And, I got to say it. I hear this especially from the Glock people, okay? And this is usually when they're dissing 1911s. And believe me, folks, I love the 1911. I've got a drawer full of them, but I have a lot of other pistols, too. It's not like the 1911 is the only thing I know how to shoot, trust me. I had taken my wife to an enhanced concealed carry course some months back, and the instructor was a very nice lady. She was with the local state narcotics bureau, and of course she carried a Glock. And she was asking me about my background and experience, and I just brought a double-action 357 revolver with me so that I could use the same ammunition as my wife. I just brought a few 138 special wad cutter rounds out there. And she kind of gave me the eye when I pulled out that 357 Magnum. And so she, walked up to the firing line and printed a very nice group with her little Glock from about 7 yards away. She looked at me and, invited me to follow her lead. So I pulled out that 357, and I printed just as nice a group with that 357 as she did with that Glock. So, and I don't even shoot revolvers that often. They're not my preferred carry weapon. I prefer single-action automatics, but I'm capable of using virtually any firearm. So then she asked me to go through some double taps on the heads, and she pointed out the three nearest silhouette targets. I pulled out it's my GP100. Of course, it was only 38 special wad cutters. I wasn't shooting full house 357. But in double action mode, pop, 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 two holes in each head. And after that, she didn't have a whole lot more to tell me about anything. But anyway, go back to the hatred of grip safeties, okay? I'm old enough to remember that a time when the Uzi submachine gun was considered to be real high tech and the new kid on the block, and just like people like XDs and Glocks and everything now, the gun magazine used to be filled with stories about Uzis. And of course, virtually no one in the United States could own one because they were selective fire weapons.
Right.
But all the gun writers were, gaga over Uzis. You ought to remember that quote from 30, 40
yep.
years ago.
Yep, I do.
Okay. And I don't recall hearing one person say one bad thing about the fact that the Uzi had a grip safety. Okay?
No, now that you mentioned it, I don't either.
No, it's a contemporary phenomenon. The thing hadn't changed. There's still probably millions of Uzis in service around the world. It's not a cutting-edge design anymore, but there's still a bunch of them out there.
Yep.
I saw a bunch of them in South Africa. I was never issued one. I got to shoot them a few times. But I don't like the Uzi for ergonomic reasons primarily. It's like the, you remember the old Mac 10 and Mac 11
yep.
little submachine guns?
Yep.
You know, they were reliable for what they were, but they were basically constructed of spot welds and box beam, and I didn't like the ergonomics on those either. But the Uzi, I mean, it's a very reliable weapon, very little to criticize about it as far as submachine guns go, and I never heard anybody criticize the fact that it had a grip safety. So what's happened in recent years is you've had this kind of war between the new Glock guys versus the old 1911 guys, and for some reason, people come up with all kind of reasons to hate grip safeties. So you don't see grip safeties on very many modern weapons. You've got the XDs, they have grip safeties, the 1911s and their knockoffs have grip safeties. Going back to the 100 years ago, the old lemon squeezer revolvers, some of them had grip safeties. As long as the grip safety doesn't impede the function of the weapon and acts in a purely passive function, I'm a great believer in them. I, you know, if they do no harm and they might prevent an ND, I say, great, let's have at it. So let's take a scenario where grip safety, and there are many scenarios, but I'll just take one basic scenario. This often happens when people get shot, and I have seen people get shot. They often drop their weapon, or it's dislodged from their grip.
Mm-hmm.
So, would you agree, Cope, or,
yeah,
or not?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I even see it in training sometimes.
Okay, so let's assume you've got a double-action, single-action auto, or a single-action-only auto pistol. And now the thing is cocked. It's in single-action, it's cocked, it's ready to fire the next round. And somebody drops the pistol, whether it's in training or whether they've been shot. Okay? I don't want the thing to hit the ground and go off, which is very easy to happen if it's cocked in single-action mode.
Right.
That grip safety stops that from happening.
Right. So they've also put a couple of drop safeties on them since, what was it, 88 or somewhere in there. They put a drop safety in the 1911s in addition to the grip safety for that reason.
Right.
Somewhere in there. I don't like grip safety. Well, grip safeties are a necessary evil as far as I'm concerned. For single-action guns, I think it's necessary. There's just too many things that can happen. Of course, the Browning High Power doesn't have one, and it's a single-action.
And I like the Browning High Power, and I wish it did have a grip safety for that exact reason.
But with, like your Glocks are double action and the XD is single action, so that's, I can understand that. The problem I have with them, and you may have seen it in some of your combat experience, or maybe not, but when you're injured, especially if you have an injury to the joint of your thumb, going back to your hand anywhere in that area, sometimes you're not able to get a good, complete grip on there. And I've seen people that have missed the grip safety on XDs, the ones that shoot thumbs forward. And I've seen that, I don't know, probably 10 times because they had to have their grip just right, which meant to me that if you just picked up a gun that you're not familiar with, you may not be able to fire it because of your grip. Now, the 1911 don't do that because it has a much wider grip safety, and it's safe that way. The XD is only like 3/8 of an inch wide, and if your grip is not just right, I watched a guy do it twice in a row, even after we told him it was going on. And he's a very experienced guy, an air marshal, extremely tuned up, but because of his grip, that XD misfired on him, or didn't fire, twice. And he finally got to shoot on the third time, and he said, you know what, never mind. I don't want one of these.
Yeah, which is understandable, but that, like so many other things you and I have discussed in the past, that's a training issue as much as anything.
Yeah, but he shouldn't have to train to just pick up a gun and shoot it. He shouldn't have, if it's a different, if the grip safety is such and he's not familiar with that particular gun, then he should, I would think that he'd be able to pick it up off the street and fire it. But we've seen several people that were not able to do that.
And another thing, you were talking about the thumb forward position in your stance, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That has become very popular in recent decades, too. And
yes,
I understand it has. I understand the wherefores and whys of it. And I will accept that it can potentially increase accuracy. This is like the communion reference earlier. I'm not saying there's a wrong and a right way here. But I was taught a long time ago, and I still use this method. You've seen it, and you'll see instructors bitch people out, and they say that's incorrect. And I keep the strong hand or the dominant hand thumb forward, and the weak and supporting hand, I keep that thumb vertical and pressed up against the dominant hand thumb. And I've had 100 instructors, or I've heard, it's just an exaggeration, but I've heard lots of instructors say, oh, no, that's the wrong way. You know, you shouldn't fire your pistol like that. You want both thumbs forward. What they don't understand is if you're being shot at, if your hands are sweaty, and especially if your hands are bloody, and I never hear instructors talk about blood. Have you ever had your hands dipped in blood? I mean, you don't have to be in combat for this. Good. Next time you shoot a deer, intentionally smear your hand with blood and feel how slippery it is.
Yep.
Blood is a tremendous lubricant, okay?
Yep.
And a lot of so-called combat instructors never seem to appreciate that. You might be shot. Your buddy might be shot. You might be trying to keep him alive while you're returning fire. You are going to get bloody, okay? And that makes it more difficult to hold on to anything, whether it's a pistol or a crescent wrench. So when you keep your dominant hand thumb forward on a pistol and your support hand thumb vertical pressing in against your dominant hand thumb, it makes for a stronger grip on the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be as accurate. I grant you that, okay? Maybe you won't win the contest. Maybe you won't take that trophy home, but it is less likely to have the pistol dislodged from your hand.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on that, Cody?
That's one of the arguments that I use. And I don't ever tell anybody what they do is wrong. What I tell them to do is, please try it my way. That's what you're paying me for. And if it doesn't work for you, or some combination of the two works for you, that's fine. But humor me for the next 2 days and try it my way. And it just and if it works, great. If it doesn't, that's okay too. But the grip that I use is very much like yours. My support side thumb is a little bit different. It's what we call thumb over thumb, fingers over fingers. You take your firing hand and go ahead and establish your regular grip, just like you were holding on to a lightsaber or something. And then you take your other hand, and with your support side thumb, it will go exactly on your firing side thumbnail. And then you wrap your hands around in front of you. You're basically just getting a two-handed grip on there. And when you do that, regardless of whether it's a Freedom Arms 22 Derringer or a 50 Action Express Desert Eagle, the middle knuckle of your support side index finger will be centered under the trigger guard 100% of the time if you do that grip right. And that's the way we show people to do it. And I have changed a lot of people that shoot thumbs forward. I say if you remove your support hand while you have that grip established, you have to again now move your thumb so the gun doesn't literally fall out of your hand. You've got to move your thumb down so that you get a good grip on there. And then when you want to reestablish your two-handed grip, you have to move your thumb up to put the gun back in place. And the whole thing just doesn't make any sense to me. The people that invented that grip, Todd Jarrett and I don't remember if Jerry Michalak had a hand in it or not. There was three of them that did it. And they come right out and said that this grip is for 1911s only. Everything else, you may have to modify it. It may or may not work for you, and it may cause some guns to malfunction. And so that's coming from the people that designed the grip to start with.
Now, let me ask you this, Cope. I just looked at the clock. I see we've got about 7 minutes to go. Do you want to go long, or do we have to end the show at the top of the hour? Because I've only gotten through half of my list.
Yeah, let's go about 10, 15 minutes long. DeTinker can square it up to an hour for us. We started a little bit late because of me, so let's go till about a quarter after.
Okay, good. I'm gonna jump ahead then. I've got this, this list of notes I've been working on through the week, but I'm not going to go in order now because of the time constraints. So
if we don't get them all, we can always do it again next week or something too.
And I'm going to go to what I think is the most important. I've probably got 15 or 20 different points here. And this is, people don't understand what possession of a defensive firearm means.
Yep.
Okay? They don't appreciate the implications. If you own a firearm of any sort for self-defense, and this includes Grandpa's old 12-gauge behind the bedroom door that hasn't been fired in 20 years, you are both a gunfighter and a gambler.
Yep.
And the problem is that most people, including most cops and CCW holders who carry weapons for self-defense, are really bad gunfighters and even worse gamblers. Note that I said most and not all.
Right.
In a deadly force incident, you have to instantly assess a lot of different tactical criteria. It's always best to avoid a shooting if possible, but I would, for instance, be willing to take more and different chances against an apparently clueless thug armed with a cheap 25 ACP pistol than I would against somebody who appeared to competently handle a 12-gauge shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
A subject's body language, stance, the way he addresses and handles his weapon can quickly give you a pretty good idea of his skill level if you are at a skill level to appreciate those
things. To recognize
things.
It, yeah.
And so, you know, it goes back to something you've said 100 times. A mere possession of a gun, it doesn't give you much of an edge if you don't know what you're doing with it.
Right. Could make things worse for you.
And, you know, every time you use that thing, man, you've got to appreciate that you're possibly going to die or cause someone else to die or possibly be wounded and maimed. It's not a thing that anyone should take lightly, and I see a lot of new gun owners who are pretty cavalier about their pistol, and they assume it confers some magical power on them, and it doesn't. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Right.
Related to that, and this is a little religious bent, I wrote, I think that if you're going to be a gunfighter, and gunfighter means anybody who uses a weapon to fight another human being. You know, an elderly widow who takes the aforementioned grandpa's 12-gauge from behind the bedroom door, the moment she picks up that weapon for defensive use, she has become a gunfighter.
Mm-hmm.
But hardly anybody has that mindset.
Right.
So, I mean, do you agree, Cope, or
absolutely,
not?
Yeah. It's we could probably spend an hour easily talking about this subject alone. The mindset of people, and I guess we could get into the importance of professional training. People buy a gun and they say, okay, that's it. They go take a little CCW class for an hour or 2 hours or maybe even a day. And all of a sudden they're pistoleros. They're ready to go out and charge out and save the world. And nothing could possibly be further from the truth. There's a whole lot, you know, just for instance, we have over, I think, 7 different handgun classes. Why would I have 7 different classes teaching different things if there was any more to it than just buying a gun? I'd have one class. Here's how you line the sights up. Here's how you pull the trigger. Put it on safety. Load the magazine. Da-da-da-da-da. And now it'll be $50. Thank you. Drive through.
Yeah. And now here in that same vein, this is from my notes. I get off on a little religious bent, but it's worth thinking about because too many Christians have a pacifistic notion, and we've all heard this nonsense, shoot to wound, don't shoot to kill, or why didn't you just shoot him in the leg?
Yeah.
Well, here's what I've got to say about that. I think that if you're going to be a gunfighter, you either have to be a believer in God or an absolute atheist. If you believe in God, you believe that there is an afterlife and you have a moral obligation to make good shoots, or at least try not to harm innocents.
Right.
This does not mean that you have to be a pacifist or refuse to fight. The Bible and other religious traditions command men to fight. If you're an atheist, you can believe in nothing at all and believe that when you die, that's the end of everything. Since everyone eventually dies, atheism confers no real moral responsibility. But if you're wrong, you have a heavy eternal debt.
Right.
I've known brave men, both good and bad, and somewhat in between, who were believers as well as atheists. As for me, I'm a believer.
Yep, me too.
So that's pretty much all I've got to say about being a gunfighter. It's just the important aspect to take away is that the moment you pick up a firearm for defensive purposes, you become a gunfighter, whether you like it it or not. Yep. So if you're going to be a gunfighter, you may as well be a damn good one, or you're probably going to lose.
Did you remember the movie Sergeant York with Gary Cooper, 1946?
Man, I don't think I've seen that since I was a kid. I remember the movie.
You got to watch that show. But in that, you talk about having a little religious bent there. He was he couldn't get past the idea of shooting to that he might accidentally have to take a human life. He was okay with being in the Army as long as we were stateside, and he was working on the range and everything. He was tickled with that. But as soon as they said they had to go to Germany, he said, no, I can't do that. You know, the good book says thou shalt not kill. And he, Wilkin, took some time off. His commanding officer told him, look, I want you to go home for a couple of weeks, and I want you to think about this and come back and tell me what you think. So he went and got the Bible and studied on things by himself for a little bit, and figured out that not only was he allowed, not only was it justified, that it was his responsibility to basically stop bad guys. So he became a tremendous, unstoppable power there when he was the guy that marched in 133 German soldiers by himself, single-handedly, right, alone, without any help.
And the Bible confers different moral responsibilities on soldiers than it does on non-combatants as
sure,
well.
Sure it does.
Okay, another, we got 10 more minutes left or so, 15 more minutes. Another pet peeve of mine is tactical crap. And I say, the American public has been enamored of anything labeled tactical.
Yep.
Pardon me. And manufacturers have responded by painting something green or camouflage, calling it tactical, and magically raising the price $100.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of so-called police and military tactical items which are really not very good for civilian concealed carry purposes. Police officers have to wear heavy-duty belts to carry a pistol, spare magazines, a taser, pepper spray, a radio, handcuffs, and other tools of the trade, which just don't have a civilian equivalent. If you think you need a radio and handcuffs, your cell phone and a couple of thick plastic electrical ties will do fine.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in a similar vein, you should think very carefully about attempting to effect a citizen's arrest or forcibly detaining a suspect. There's a lot more training involved in doing this safely and effectively than most people realize, and there are possible legal consequences. So, I'm not saying never do it. I went through a lot of training on detaining people in a military context. And, I mean, if you think what you see on that TV show, Cops, how cops handle people roughly, it's nothing compared to how we were trained to take captured terrorists in.
Yeah.
And the Army encouraged us to capture terrorists instead of shooting them when it was possible and when it was safe, because they wanted the intelligence. Okay? So I'm not saying anything was inhumane per se, but that training was very rough compared to what you see American law enforcement commonly use on the streets.
Right.
If you want to detain someone, again, it's just like using the firearm. You ought to have training in how to do it with a professional trainer. Otherwise, if you get in a gunfight to save your life and the gunfight is over and the subject or the perp has run away, let them run, man. Let the cops go chase them. That's what they get paid for. You're a taxpayer. You're paying their salary for them to do
mm-hmm.
it.
Same with
Makes
room
sense.
Clearing.
Same with what, Cope?
Same with room clearing. Yeah. If you have to do it, know how to do it right. But otherwise, let them do what we pay them for.
Well, I've got a different take on that, too. I don't, for the most part, and this is in a military context, I'm not a big believer in room clearing unless there's an absolute need for it. I mean, that's what you've got artillery or airstrikes for.
Right.
If you know the bad guys are in the house, okay, pilots make the big bucks, man. Call in the airstrike, okay? We used to have something called a Patmore. It was a little 60-millimeter patrol mortar. And it's man-portable. It had a tiny base plate, and it just had a line painted down the barrel. That's how you aimed it, and then it had a bubble or spirit level so you could get your range.
Yeah.
Okay? And, you know, I mean, not arguments, but I would talk to, like, you know, our junior officers, lieutenants and such about their tactical doctrine. And, you know, my question was always, hey, we got these Patmores, man. Why don't we just light them up from 100 yards away? Why go into this crawl? And, you know, There's as much political decisions that go into that as there is tactical decisions, though.
Yep, agreed.
Obviously, you know, you don't want American police departments to carry 60-millimeter mortars and start firing up houses. I get that. Now, let's talk about a holster my son loved, and that was a military-issued drop-leg holster, okay? They're terrible holsters. They're in the wrong position. They had a flap and a retention device. You know, I point out soldiers need to wear heavy web gear, camelback water carriers, countless mag and grenade pouches, heavy rucksacks, body armor, possibly communications gear, link belt ammunition, mortar bombs, and all kinds of other equipment that civilians don't need. Okay, so the drop leg pistol, really the only advantage of it is it keeps it out of the way of all the other stuff they're carrying.
Right.
But it's not in and of itself a good holster.
Nope, that's the only holster I've ever lost a gun out of. I lost my high power one time, low crawling, do some stuff, and had to go back and find it. Not a fan.
And this is, yeah, in relation to holsters, another common shortcoming of police and military holsters is that nearly all of them have retention features. These may be appropriate for certain uniform officers who are on patrol and risk having their weapon taken by a criminal, or military purposes where an enemy might try to take a pistol or there's a risk of losing it. But for concealed carry, I don't like retention features. I don't care what they are. Some of them are safe, but they are all slower than a holster that doesn't have a retention feature. And as you know, some of the retention features are actually dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just agreeing with you. Some of them are that way. I strongly recommend against some of them. But the you know, you take the molded holsters, the molded Kydex holsters, rigid holsters, where it snaps around the trigger guard, that doesn't slow you down any more than, you know, you can adjust that to whatever you need. So if you can get on a high flying trapeze or something, you can keep from dropping it out.
And you're right about that, and I have no argument. But that's a passive retention feature.
Right.
It's no more active than the friction of the leather against a belt slide holster that I favor. So yeah, technically that's a retention feature, but it's not an active retention feature where you have to push a button or manipulate a gizmo or do something like that.
Yeah.
And again, I like the KISS approach, K-I-S-S, keep it simple, stupid. So, you know, the fewer things that you have in your personal rig to go wrong, the fewer things are likely to go wrong.
Yeah. Can't argue that.
We haven't actually disagreed on too much.
Not much. No, not yet. If you got a lot of stuff on your list, we can do it again next week and see if we can get a little more active here.
Well, you want me to just go through one more, or do we still have like 5 minutes left?
Yeah, we got about 7 minutes.
Okay. My next pet peeve is firearms expense. People all too frequently equate expensive handguns with being good handguns. And this is sometimes true, but equally it's not. Cope, earlier you said it was embarrassing. You'd see guys come out with $6,000 or $7,000 custom pistols that didn't work.
Yeah.
Okay. So the mere fact that you spent a lot of money on a pistol does not necessarily mean you have a good pistol. I mentioned this earlier when we began the show. I was talking about pocket pistols. And, you know, I don't like front pocket carry. I just do it sometimes because it's so hot and humid here in the deep south.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you're going to carry concealed, that's your option, right? I know it gets hot out where you're at, but you don't have 98% humidity.
Nope.
It's a different type of heat. You know, it's like the old Arizona travel brochure said, yes, but it's a dry heat.
that's right.
And that's absolutely correct, okay? So let's look at my two pocket pistols, the ones I'll use for front pocket carry. One of them is a little Makarov, Russian Makarov. It's one of the least expensive pistols out there. It's reliable as a hammer. And then the other one I mentioned, that .357 Bodyguard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's probably a $700 pistol because it's a semi-collectible, it's a pre-locked version, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, it's only got 5 rounds, but that can be 5 rounds of full house .357. That's nothing to sneeze at.
Not at all.
So on the one hand, my two favorite carry pistols, my pocket pistols for front pocket carry. One of them is this cheap little Makarov, a little Russian Makarov, which is not much more powerful than a 380, and the other is that J-Frame Smith & Wesson. Vastly different in expense, but they're both reliable, and they'll both do what I want them to do.
Right.
Well, you're still not disagreeing with me.
No, I'm not. There's not much. Doc, you've got a... I disagree with the people that don't know what they're talking about, but you pretty much know what you're talking about, so I have nothing to disagree with yet, man.
Okay. Let's see. Well, one, I mean, we've kind of gone through already. It's training. I said, know your weapon. You should shoot the hell out of it, and at minimum, field strip it till you can almost do it in your sleep. Practice all of your clearance and malfunction drills. It's good to know how to detail strip your weapon, but virtually on all handguns, you can cause damage by incorrect or too much detail stripping. Mm-hmm. So I don't see that as being essential. In any case, there's no combat situation where detail stripping could do you the least bit of good.
No.
Now, just as an anecdote, in a certain quasi-government instructional institution that I attended in southern Africa, they had us train on primarily 1911s and Browning high powers. And they would put a black fabric bag over your head. Now, it was fabric. You could breathe through it, but you couldn't see through it.
Yeah.
And you had to field strip and reassemble the pistol you were using in 60 seconds or less. And if you couldn't do that, very bad things happened to you. And believe me, you didn't want those very bad things to happen to you. So pretty much everyone in the class got to the point where they could do that. I got to the point where I could do it in much less than 60 seconds. But that was, you know, practice that with your own pistol. Put a bag over your head or just, you know, close your eyes and don't cheat.
Yeah.
And sit there and learn the idiosyncrasies of that weapon. You're going to find things you hadn't even considered before, like springs that are going to fly 20 or 30 feet away. You know, so obviously learn it with your eyes open and take your time and then get faster and faster. Learn the idiosyncrasies of the pistol, because remember, it's just a machine, okay? And then start trying it with your eyes closed.
Yep.
Practice all that stuff till you can virtually do it in your sleep.
I haven't detail stripped my Glock with my eyes closed, but I have done a... I've done my Glock and I've done the Ruger Mark IIs. The only reason I did the Mark IIs is because everybody said it was so difficult and so hard to do, and I can take it apart and put it back together in 45 seconds, blindfolded.
It is difficult to do. I own a Mark II, and they are difficult when you first get them. They have a lot of idiosyncrasies that most pistols don't, but you're right. After you do it a few times and you learn the pistol, it's pretty easy.
Yeah. Yeah, that one little trick there of tilting it back and let that hammer strut fall out of the way. Once you get that, then it's a piece of cake.
I tell you what, I've got one last pet peeve, and then we can close out the show tonight. And we can do it again in the future if you'd like.
Sure.
My last pet peeve is a belief in supernatural cartridge capabilities. And this is true in handguns as well as rifles. Handgun and rifle ballistics are pretty simple. They come down to matters of physics for the most part. Yeah, you can have a little better bullet design, you can have different bullet weights and such, but all this stuff pretty much comes down to physics. So, you know, I love the 45 ACP as a fighting cartridge, but I don't think it's a good hunting cartridge. I think it's a good fight-stopping cartridge, but it's not especially lethal. If I had the unfortunate choice of having to be shot by a handgun, for instance, I'd much rather be shot by a 45 ACP FMJ round than a 357 Magnum hollow point.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Hell yes.
But statistics indicate that they're both pretty much on a par for stopping the fight. Not lethality, but stopping the fight, which
right.
Should be your primary concern, okay? And I've shot several. I did this years ago when I was a kid, mainly. I stopped doing it because it didn't work well. You know, I'm a big hog hunter, or used to be. I love to hunt wild pigs. And I've shot a bunch of pigless 45s that didn't magically roll over and die. And I've shot a couple of big dangerous dogs with 45s that didn't magically roll over and die. It certainly got their attention, but, you know, it's not like a death ray, okay? So on the rare occasions that I would hunt medium-sized game with a handgun, and I'd say the rare occasions because what that usually involved is I'd go out in the marshes down here to go fishing, and I would bring a handgun with me on the off chance that I would run into a hog, because they're very prolific down here in the swamps and the marshes.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I wanted to take the boat out and just go fishing for a day, and I wasn't primarily hunting, I might take a handgun with me in case I had a opportunistic shot at a nice pig, okay? But, you know, I wouldn't... it's been decades since I'd take a 45 ACP to do that. I'd take usually my 44 Magnum or maybe a 357 Magnum. And, yeah, I know there are a lot more powerful choices now, but nothing comes close to the 44 or the 357 for component availability.
Right.
You know, if I need something more powerful than the 44, I'll go to a long gun. And it doesn't have to be expensive. I've shot a lot of pigs with a 12-gauge pump, a riot gun, my Mossberg 500, cylinder bore, using slugs, because most pig shots are very close range. And, again, you know, it's not supernatural capability. If you hit anything with 7/8 of an ounce of a chunk of lead, it's probably going down.
More than likely, yeah. Yep.
Guns I use a lot in the marshes, and this is kind of getting a little off topic of magical calibers, but I've taken a few nice guns down into the marshes and the swamps, and no matter how careful you are, you're going to get salty water or mud splatter on them. So I gave that up a long time ago, and now I take full house main battle rifle rounds down there, usually a surplus Mauser or even a Mosin in 7.62x54. And they're inexpensive, and they have more than enough power to get the job done. I had tried for a while taking a SKS into the marsh, and I lost a couple of pigs because the cartridge just didn't have enough ass to it.
Yeah.
You know, the animals died, no doubt, but they died out in that marsh grass where it was impossible to track them. They may have only died 50 feet away, and you couldn't find them. You hit an animal with 30-06, 8mm Mauser, 7.62x54 Russian, it's pretty much going to drop right there.
Yep, I agree. That's I got to get down there. I've hunted the pigs a little bit in Georgia, but not a whole lot. And I'd like to get out there somewhere where there's a lot of them, Texas or wherever, and go out and do a little experimenting. I think it'd be fun.
And, I guess we're out of time now. So my last thing is training. I mean, we've talked about this a couple of times. We've made reference to it. But I point out that you cannot read an article in a magazine about some new technique and then assume that you can now employ that technique effectively. You need to practice, and preferably with a trainer in a real-world environment.
Yep, that's the only way to do it. You can get some ideas through videos and stuff, and you may feel like you're doing it right, but until the guy that made the video watches you, it's going to be hard to say if you're doing it the way he'd like for you to do it. So it may be better than nothing, but I don't think it's ideal.
So that pretty much covers my list of pet peeves for the evening, but I've got a bunch more if you want to do this again in a week or two.
All right. Yeah, it sounds like fun. We can do that again. We're going to do some changes here sometime after about the first of the month. I'm not sure what those changes are going to be yet, but we're kind of leaning towards probably 2 hours Monday, 2 hours Wednesday, and 3 hours Friday. But I'm not sure yet. I'm still kind of up in the air. Not getting the feedback that I wanted to. I've got one of our listeners that's offered me some really good ideas and advice, but that's all we're hearing from, so that's what I'm going to be taking, I guess. So, let's see. You guys help that anonymous out there. I don't know if he's hearing us or what. But all right, Doc. Well, I appreciate you coming in here tonight. It was a pretty short hour. Actually, we're a little over an hour now. It still went by too quickly. So maybe
I had fun. I hope you did too.
Oh yeah, I enjoyed it. We didn't get into anything that I really disagreed with much. So there's you've got your poop in a group there on the gun. So I can't disagree with you too much.
So I trust you'll be placing your order for a new 1911 next week.
we'll talk about that next time. That's,
all right, my friend, I appreciate it. It's been fun. I'll look forward to it again soon, and you have a great night.
All right, Doc. Good night, and thank you again.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. All right, guys, we're going to get on out of here. I hope you enjoyed that. It was fun. We figured we'd disagree a whole lot more on stuff, but you just can't find too much wrong with Doc's reasoning there. So... all right, we're going to get out of here. Like I said, there's going to be some changes on the shooting bench coming up the 1st of August. Not sure yet, but we're looking at 2, possibly 3 hours on Monday, 2 hours on Wednesday, and 3 hours on Friday. The first hour on Friday will be news and mopping up from earlier in the week. And the last 2 hours will be Liberty Lounge. So that's what I'm looking at right now. If anybody has any objections to it, you better speak now or forever hold your peace. The other thing we're looking at doing, we're tossing around some ideas here of either subscriptions or paying for podcast or charging for the podcast or something like that. Of course, we could avoid all that if we could get a few people every once in a while to click on that donate button up there in the upper right-hand corner of the chat room. Then we could probably not worry about that. Or if you just wanted to use PayPal, just go to the shooting bench, go to PayPal, and then use the shooting bench at live.com for the email address. And you don't even have to have a PayPal account. And you can donate right there to keep everything running. So anyway, we're going to get on out of here. We'll be back tomorrow night with Liberty Lounge, and Amy will be back in a month or so. And we'll see you then. Good night. Okay, let's call it a day, and thank you for joining me. Join me every Monday through Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific Time for the Shooting Bench, right here on Just Measures Radio Network. Let freedom free. Let the world sing. Thank you.